Hi, I'm Jenna Manatic. I got to tell you, I'm feeling a little bit nervous today. There's a lot of people here. And I actually started feeling nervous a couple of days ago when I realized that I was speaking on the ninth step, which to me is like real personal. Like, what had happened was they called me and they offered me two different topics. And the first topic, like, seemed like something fun to talk about, you know, real, like, powerlessness stuff and who can't talk about active addiction and how crazy I was. And that seemed like real easy and fun to do, you know. But it was at, like, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I thought there was no way I'll get there on time. So I was like, oh, I'll do the ninth step. And then it struck me what I had agreed to come in here and talk about, actually talk in front of a group of strangers about working the ninth step and what that meant in my life. And, like, the fear set in. Oh, my God, the fear, like, of, like, opening up to all these people about who I really am. And I freaked out, so I decided to go shopping. That seemed reasonable. And so I get all the way to the store, and I'm, like, in the dressing room, and it occurs to me that no matter how many clothes I buy, it's not going to make me sound like I know what I'm talking about. But I was already there, so I bought a new dress anyway. Whatevs. So I don't really know how to start except from the beginning. So just to qualify a little bit, like, I used a lot. I started using early and often, I like to say. I got clean the first time when I was 17. And I came into this program, and I was like, oh, this is what I've been looking for. And it was great for a while. And then I got busy doing, you know, important shit with a capital I, right? And going to college, buying a house, married, kids, homeschooling my children, and I stopped going to meetings because I was too busy, and I stopped calling a sponsor, and I stopped reading the books, and pretty soon I had stopped doing so many things that the only thing left to do was to get high. So that's what I did. And holy Moses. When they say the disease does not stop progressing while I'm not getting high, that didn't make sense to me. I didn't believe that. And then all of a sudden, bam, there I was. Like, whoa, like I had never stopped. And I say all that to say that, like, the real damage that I did in my addiction, I did it in relapse. Because when I got clean the first time, I didn't have anything to lose, and I didn't have anybody counting on me. But the second time around, man, I had two kids that I was completely devoted to. And I had, you know, the respect of my community, and I had a job that trusted me, and my family, I had won their trust back. And I gave that all away. I traded it all in for the drugs. Two cars, and, you know, all the stuff of recovery, but more than that, like, the love and respect and trust of my family and the people around me. So, like, I hit bottom, and then I bounced around on it for a while. I literally lost everything, just walked away from it. I didn't lose it. I knew where it was, but that's not where the dope was, and I needed to be where the dope was, so I left my family, and I went to where the dope was. And through, like, I don't know, just the craziest set of circumstances that seem magic to look back on it now, but I know it was grace, I wound up in a treatment center, and I wound up being reintroduced to Narcotics Anonymous. I had lost something, like, it somehow in my relapse, I had started to believe that I only had one chance at this thing, and that it wasn't for me anymore, that I had somehow blown this one shot. And you know, like, how our minds get twisted up, and I just couldn't believe that I could come back here. And I don't know, now that seems crazy, but at the time it was so real. And so when I came here and I came back in with my tail between my legs and my head hanging down, and people just hugged me and said the coffee's in the back, like, thank you. Thank you for that. So it was pretty clear to me early on that I was powerless over my addiction. And my life was fairly unmanageable in that I was homeless and unemployable, and my family hadn't heard from me in months, and I had been arrested so many times that I couldn't, that I stopped putting the shoelaces in my shoes. 'Cause I was just like, why? You're just gonna take them back. I wish that was a joke. So that part was pretty easy for me to wrap my head around, you know. And the part, like the second step of like coming to believe that there was something better for me, that God could restore me to sanity, that my life could look anything like sane. Like, that was a little bit harder, but I started coming to meetings, and I started seeing, because, you know, they made me, and I started seeing people who talked about the same corners that I hung out on, and they talked about doing the same things that I had done, and they didn't look crazy. So I thought, well, maybe if it worked for them, maybe it can work for me. So with the help of a sponsor, I turned my will and my life over to the care of a power greater than myself. And to me, like, a big part of that third step means doing the fourth step. Because I believe in the steps. Like, I've turned my will and my life over to the steps of Narcotics Anonymous and to this program, as well as to a loving God. And so that meant I needed to keep going. And so I did a fourth step, and I learned about me. Now, I hesitated on the fourth step out of sheer laziness, right? Because at the time, I was still pretty, like, fearless, like, you know, like that street kind of fearless. You know, not real courage, but like, blah, you can't hurt me. But I'm just generally lazy, and so I didn't want to do it. But then once I started, like, it so quickly was just amazing to me how fast I started seeing patterns in myself, and how quickly I started learning about who I really am, and how quickly I started learning that maybe the people that I had always blamed my problems on weren't necessarily the ones at fault. Ouch. 'Cause see, that's my deal. Something goes wrong in my life, and the first thing I want to do is blame it on somebody, preferably a man. Start with that guy, and I can work it all the way back to my dad. It doesn't matter, just the guy closest to me, whoever, I don't even have to know him. Something went wrong, it must be his fault. So, like, you know, I started doing this fourth step, and pretty quickly started seeing that, you know, all my relationships were exactly the same. Like, the faces had changed, but the relationship was the same, and what they had in common was me. And so, you know, I shared that crazy with a sponsor, and, you know, and there's a reason for the fifth step. If you're thinking, if you're here and you're thinking, well, I'll do the fourth step, but I ain't telling nobody. I get it. I have felt that way. Don't do that to yourself. I need to share my crazy with somebody else because I need to get another perspective on it. Because if it just keeps bouncing around my own head, it just gets worse and worse and worse. It just grows like a snowball, right? I need to get it out and hear somebody else's take on it. And I need to be able to relate with somebody else's struggles. So that's what I did, and then I like to say the sixth step. I didn't work the sixth step. The sixth step worked me. Because my experience is that what happened was I was like, I hadn't changed yet, but now I'm aware. So I'm still doing the same things, but I see it as I'm doing it, and when it hurts, I feel like I've kicked my own self in the ass. Like, how do I even do that? So it's like twice as painful because I know I'm the one at fault. And so when I struggled enough with that, I asked God for help. You know, I humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. Because first I want to fix things myself. First I want to be like, nope, I got this. I'm not going to be that way anymore. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And then do it. So I had to humbly ask. Which, of course, led me to the eighth step. Oh, BT Dubs, humbly asking does not mean they're magically erased. Who knew? I still had the character defects, but I had asked, so there's hope that they can be removed. So I got to this eighth step, and I made a list. And the fourth step, like I said, I was so like, wow, by the fourth step that it wasn't particularly painful for me. The eighth step was harder. It was a lot harder to write down the people, not just the ways that I had messed up, not just how the things that I did, not just my character defects, but the actual individual people that I had hurt and how I had hurt them, who I had stolen from, whether it was money or drugs or peace of mind or their childhood. Like that was heavy on my heart. So actually I should back up, but because before I ever got to the eighth step, I made my first financial amend against my will. The federal government didn't care what step I was on. They just take theirs. I was not okay with that. I was not all right with them taking my hard-earned money. We'll come back to that. So, and then this is my very most favorite favorite ninth step story, and this was my first ninth step amend that I made of my own volition. And the people who know and love me have all heard this story, but my dad lived in this little apartment. He had himself a little bachelor pad up above this business, and the business was owned by Mr. Dickey. I'd known him since I was a little kid. We live in a little town, or I grew up in a little town. I don't live there anymore. But every time I would go to see my dad, there'd be Mr. Dickey. Oh, when I was getting high, I wrote two bad checks to Mr. Dickey. He cashed these checks for me, and I never looked back. Pew! So now years have passed. Every time I go to town, I got to ride by Mr. Dickey's. Every time I go to see my dad, there's Mr. Dickey. I got my head down. I'm like, I'm avoiding him. I'm calling Dad and getting him to meet me somewhere else. And, you know, this money was just eating at me. I owed Mr. Dickey money. I knew I had done him wrong. Drove me crazy for months. And finally one day I said, I can't take it anymore. And I whipped in and I go inside and I say, Mr. Dickey, I owe you some money. And he said, what? I said, I wrote some checks that didn't exactly clear a while ago, and I would like to pay you for them. And he said, you did? So he goes over to the bulletin board, and he like literally blew the dust off some stuff, dug around, found these checks, and it was like a total of like $50. And I paid him, and I walked out of there free. It was obvious that $50 didn't mean nothing to Mr. Dickey. He had long ago forgot about it. But what it did for me, I could look him in the eye. And the book talks about we want to look people in the eye without aggressiveness nor fear. And that's what I got from that $50. I could walk into Mr. Dickey's with my head held high. Have you seen my dad? And I was like, okay, all right, this is where it's at. And then I understood, you know, the book talks about we can't afford to avoid this step. Because if we do, we are reserving a place in our program for relapse. And I understood why, like this, like I've been, had been changing up until then. I, you know, I'm working the steps, I'm going to meetings, I'm doing what I'm told, you know, mostly. I'm not an angel or nothing. But the real changes started happening in the ninth step. Like, that's when I started finding that freedom I'd been promised in here. That's when I started finding out that I could be somebody different, that I could be better than who I had been. And what an amazing process that was. Now, I don't think that the ninth step will ever be completely done for me. Some days I add names to that list faster than I can knock them off. But it's been an amazing process so far. So all right. So with financial amends, I've got this list of financial amends, and man, when to see them all in a list and do the math, I thought I will never get out of debt. I literally thought there's no way I can ever get out of debt. Why bother trying? And then, like I said, the federal government helped me out with that. It gave me a little kick. And slowly, I started working on some stuff. I started paying some stuff off. And here was the big part for me, was to realize, because like I said, I was mad. I was mad when they said I needed still owed them this money. I'm like, but that was so long ago. What you mean you didn't forget about that $15,000? I did. And I really had to come to terms with something. And this was what changed the tide for me. It's not my money. It might be sitting in my bank account. It might be in my checking account. And I might have other plans for it. But it's not my money. It belongs to those people that I borrowed it from. It belongs to those people that I stole it from. It always has been their money. If I keep holding on to it when I know it ain't mine, then I'm just continuing to do wrong. And that's what the ninth step is about to me. It's about change. We talk about making an amends, and an amends is not an apology, right? I apologized all the time when I was getting high. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I stole your car. I'm sorry I stole your money. I'm sorry I didn't come home. I'm sorry. I was very sorry, and nobody wanted to hear it anymore. This is something different. This is a change. This is a change in my behavior. This is a reparation. This is restitution. Restoration. That's what the ninth step is about. Now, saying I'm sorry may have a part in it. There are times when it does. But that ain't the whole story. I need to fix it, and I need to stop doing it. You know, the old joke about the person stuck in the hole, and the lawyer comes by and sees the person stuck in the hole and tells him he'll sue somebody, and engineer comes by and sees the guy stuck in the hole and he's trying to figure out how to build a staircase, and the addict comes by and sees the dude stuck in the hole and he says, stop digging, right? Put down the shovel, because even clean, I was still digging that hole in a lot of ways. Maybe not financially, mostly because nobody would lend me money. Let's be real. I'd burn all those bridges. But emotionally, you know, I was still manipulating people. I still wasn't showing up for my responsibilities. I was still doing harm in a lot of ways. And the first thing I needed to do was stop digging. Start changing that behavior and make a real living amends. You know, and when it came to the most important amends, I don't know if most important is the right word, but the people that were closest to me, my kids, my parents, my family, you know, at first all I could do was show up. That's where my amends started, was showing up. If I say I'm going to be there at 8 o'clock, showing up at 8 o'clock. If I say I'm going to a meeting and I'll be back in an hour and a half, actually coming back in an hour and a half. Not the next day, not in 3 hours, in an hour and a half, just like I said. Telling the truth. Doing what I said I was going to do. And then showing up for them in real ways, like being in their life. And like, honestly, that part was hard at first. When I first got clean, like, I was scared. I didn't want anything to upset the apple cart. I was so afraid of getting high again. And to me, my family felt like an emotional minefield, and I didn't want to go around them. But like over time, I started dealing with that. I started showing up a little bit here and there, and showing up for the big things, and it got better. And today it's a lot better. So the step goes on to say, it says we made direct amends, direct, without intermediaries. Why is that important? Because I love intermediaries. sis, tell mom I'm not going to make it, right? Tell mom. So I can't do that anymore. I got to stand on my own 2 feet, right? I got to make my own amends. So we made amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Wherever possible. There are times when it's not possible. You know, for lots of reasons. Sometimes it's a matter of access or availability. We don't know where people are. Maybe I don't even know who some people are. There are people out there that I've harmed that I just have no idea. Maybe God will see fit to put them in my face again, and maybe I'll remember them, and we'll deal with it then. But then there's people who died, and that one's tougher for me. Briefly, my niece and nephew, I was very close with them when they were little. Like I said, I was clean before, so I was somebody that people looked up to. And then I relapsed. And so they were teenagers, and they watched me spin out of control at a time when maybe they needed somebody to look up to. I wasn't there. Now, did I do them direct harm? I can't remember ever actually stealing money from them. I can't remember ever actually, you know, doing, but I wasn't there, and I disappointed them, and I know that. And I don't know if I had been different, would their lives have been different? I don't know. There's no way of knowing that, because what happened is they both died 5 years ago. And I can't fix that. You know, there's no way I can go back and fix that for them. Or to make an amends, to direct amends to them. What I can do is to show up and help other addicts, because they both had this disease, and they both died as a result. And so where I can't help them, I can help another person. You know, so when somebody calls me and says I need a ride to detox, I'm doing it for Bergen. If somebody says that they can't go out to the diner because they can't afford their own dinner, Oh, I'm buying dinner for Brittany. I can do that. I can help somebody else's kids. So the step goes on to say that the other time that we can't make amends directly is when it would injure them or others. The book's very clear about this. I don't get to clear my conscience at the expense of someone else. That's not fair. How is that okay? Now I feel free and you're stuck with my shit. Not cool. And there's some stuff that my parents don't need to know about. There's some stuff that my kids don't need to know about. If they come to my anniversary, I don't share about certain things because they don't need to have those pictures. They don't need to have that in their mind. But then there's other stuff. Couple years into this process, I started dating a man in here who had other commitments. Dude, it was ridiculous, right? It was the worst kept secret in Narcotics Anonymous. Swear to God. We were in love. And we would break up and, you know, oh, I got to do the right thing. You got to do the right thing. And it'd be super dramatic. And we'd get back to, we'd be like sitting in meetings, staring at each other across the room, right? And we'd get back together. And it went on and on and on. And it ended so poorly. Of course, because how else could it end, right? Like, oh, I think I can get into this being super selfish and not caring about anybody else but me, and somehow it's going to work out best, right? It's going to work out all right for me. No, that's not how it works. So it ended terribly. And there I was, crushed, destroyed, and wanting to get high. And I thought to myself, oh, I should just get high. What? Like, this is all in my head, right? Oh, hell no. He gots to go. And that was the end of that, because I can't put anything in front of my recovery. I walked away from my family. I let somebody else raise my children so I could stay clean. You think I'm going to get high over some dude? No offense, y'all. No. No. Okay, so now I'm left with this harm, right? Because I took this man away from his family. What do I do about that? Well, I tell you what I don't do. I don't go knock on her door and say, excuse me, I was sleeping with your man. No, that's not fair. That's not fair. I can't do that to her, right? Have there been times I wanted to? Sure. But I cannot clear my conscience at the expense of someone else's peace of mind. That's not fair. So what I can do is not sleep with your husband. Thank you. If you marry, don't worry. I don't want him. I can't speak for the rest of them, but you're safe here. It's about changing behaviors. So much to talk about. Put this one off because it's hard to talk about. So I told you all I had a couple of kids, and man, I was so devoted. I mean, I was that hippie, crunchy mom. I like family bed, extended breastfeeding, homeschooled, like completely devoted to these boys. And I relapsed, and I lost my damn mind. And their life changed as a result of that, obviously. you know, I started drinking, I started getting high, I started progressing. At first it was, you know, mommy's not getting up in the mornings, and then, you know, it's getting worse and worse. And then eventually what happened was that I was strung out, and I couldn't get that far away from the dope anymore. Where they lived was 2 hours away from the dope. Tells you how long I've been clean. I don't think there's anywhere that's 2 hours away from dope nowadays. sadly. But at the time there was. At the time we had to travel for it. And so they were too far away. And so I knew they were okay. My ex-husband was a good dad. When they weren't with him, they were with my mom, and I knew that they were cared for and fed. And somehow in my mind, I made myself believe that they were better off without me, because I was so messed up and I put them in danger. And honestly, they probably were better off without me. I put them in danger. I did them harm. I stole their birthday money. And the times that I came home were getting farther and farther apart. And my youngest son was just a little guy. He was, he was little. And he was 10 when I got clean. So he's like 5, 6 years old, 7 years old, and he still believed. Like, he was the last one to figure it out. And he still believed that I was going to come home and take care of him. Yeah. And so he would stand at the door. He would watch the cars coming down the road, hoping that this one will be mom. Okay, maybe this one will be mom. For hours and hours. I can't take that away. Nothing I can do will change that. And no amount of his grandmother's cooking was going to change that. Damn it, I wear makeup like twice a year and I just cried it off. So when I got clean, he was 10, and my older son was 13, and like I said, they were the last ones to figure it out. They were also the last ones to give me a break. They were like, yeah, we'll see. Sure, she's clean. And they weren't really fooling with me at first. By that point, it had not only been a long time since I'd seen them, it had been a long time since they stopped looking for me, honestly. You know, I got arrested. Like I said, I got arrested a bunch of times, but then the last time they held on to me for a little while, and nobody was looking for me anymore. And so when I came back home and I started, like, here I am, I'm clean now. They were like, okay, we got things to do. See you later. And I kept showing up anyway. They had no interest in living with me, and they still haven't lived with me since that day. And part of me growing in this process was having to be okay with that, was figuring out that where they were was just fine, that that's where they felt safe, and it was going to take some time for them to come, for them to trust me again, and it would only further the harm if I ripped them away from their father or even attempted to. So I started just showing up. And I started, you know, showing up for his taekwondo belt ceremonies and showing up to plays and showing up whenever they would have me. I'm there for every holiday and visiting whenever I could. And then eventually, like, they started coming over to my house once in a while. Not a lot. They still don't come a lot. I'm like, I live at the beach. Come on. But they started to trust me again, and that became clear. And they started being willing to get in a car with me. That was a big day. That was a big day for me when they got in a car with me. Because I had taken them to Cobb. Two little country kids up in Baltimore City. So they just stopped riding with me. Little, like seriously, like five, like no, I'm not. So when they got in the car, like that was a big deal for me. And then a few years ago, like they came on vacation with me. Like, wow, like this is working. I'm showing up. I'm doing what I say I'm going to do. I'm helping them whenever I can. You know, because I didn't help financially for a long time. So if I can help here and there now, then right on. Then I do that. That's my job. And it started paying off, and it started becoming apparent that it was paying off, but there was still something eating at me. And so finally, separately, last year, another thing, I started talking to them about addiction early on. As soon as they would listen to me, I started talking to them about addiction because I need them to know. I can't stop them from being addicts, but they can't say they didn't know. Right? They can't do that. So I don't hold anything back when it comes to that. And that's part of my process with them. And then I guess about 2 years ago, I sat down with each of them separately and I said, you know, I've waited a long time to have this conversation with you, but I know what I did. And I take responsibility for what I did. And I can't ever change that. And I can't ever give you that your childhood back. I don't know that I can ever make you feel safe again. But what I can tell you is that I am sorry to the bottom of my soul. I am so sorry that I never stopped loving you. In every jail cell, on every street corner, everywhere I was, I never stopped loving my children, and I told them that. And I hoped that they could forgive me. And I didn't ask them to forgive me, but that I hoped that we could be okay, you know. And we cried, mostly me, some of them. And individually, they told me that they understood. Not completely, you know, because they've never been there, but that they knew who, they know who I am. They know who I was before I relapsed, and then they know who I am now. And they know that I would never intentionally hurt them. And my oldest son told me that anybody who's ever sat with me for an hour couldn't help but to love me. As sweet as that is, if you knew him, you'd know how sweet it really was, because that is, I promise you, the nicest thing he's ever said about anybody in his whole life. Being able to have that conversation, that's freedom, you know, and that's from Narcotics Anonymous, you know. And in this chapter in the book, it talks about how free do you want to be. And for me, once I got that first taste of it, once I got that freedom from that debt with Mr. Dickey, I knew I wanted to keep going. And I still, do I still have debts? Absolutely. Some have been forgotten about years ago, except I haven't. I always love to hear when people say, you know, oh, my mom just, or my dad just told me, you know, don't worry about the money. I'm just glad you're clean. My dad wants his money. He's glad I'm clean, but he wants his money. But the relationships that I have today as a result of showing up, as a result of working this ninth step, as a result of making some living amends, and as a result of making some direct amends with my debtors, with the people in my life, with my family, I have my family back. I have my children in my life. I have the best relationship with my father I've ever had in my entire life. He goes on vacation with us every year, and I've been able to show up for him for some real stuff this year, and that's an amazing feeling. You know, this guy showed up to visit me when I was in jail. He dropped off commissary when I was in jail, and today to be able to walk through some heavy stuff with him, to be able to walk through some scary stuff with him and not wait for him to ask, but just to show up. Dad, I'm here. I got you. That is an amazing feeling. And y'all did that. Y'all taught me how to do that. Thank you so much. Thank you, Narcotics Anonymous, for this life I have today on behalf of my family. They thank you. My hometown thanks you. Because on my own, on my own, I will do drugs until I die. And I will cause untold damage in the process. But here, I can be somebody better. Thank you so much.